Okay, great. Good morning, everyone. And I want to thank Tobias and the other organizers again for having me here. It's been a really interesting and different 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks. I learned a lot. A lot of it was over my head. And I'll try to tell you about some things that isn't pitched over your head. But please interrupt at any point. Okay, so you had an introduction last week about Birdsong, and Bruno, you're the only new member here, and you know a lot about Birdsong, so I'm going to go pretty quickly through the background. But, you know, this is one of the reasons why we care and one of the reasons why NIH funds this research.
If you want to know more information about a fact, you can. Go on there. Go to Google. Helps you know anything to me. I'll be looking forward to hearing from anyone out there that have the same problem like me, or you want to get to know me, because I'm at this moment, I'm very know me, I've got no friends.
Okay, so how many of you have heard of the gene FOXP2? It's a transcription factor. It's the first single gene mutation linked to a language disorder. This is an orofacial dyspraxia. Manifested in a British family, the KE family, where this gene was first isolated in about 2000. I will just summarize it by saying this gene is highly conserved throughout the vertebrate lineage. It's almost identical between mice and humans and almost identical between birds and humans, despite 300 million years of evolutionary separation. The major anatomical insult in the brain of afflicted individuals is a reduction in the head of the caudate. Nucleus, a part of the basal ganglia that's thought to be important to orofacial and craniofacial sensory motor integration. So that should strike a bell, given that I talked to you last week about basal ganglia circuits in birdsong. Again, just to introduce this is the primary model we use in our group to study vocal learning. It's one of the few non-human species that learns to vocalize, and they transmit their vocalizations in this very rapid, let's see if this works. And this very rapid vocalization known as song. And the adult male in the background sings this song, sometimes in the presence of a juvenile male like this one here. And that catapults the vocal trajectory of the juvenile so that this unstructured vocalization, which is about as long as a typical song prior to exposure to the Tudor model, which is shown in the upper right there, changes into something that reflects a very, very good copy to our ears, an almost perfect copy, and to songbirds' ears, not quite a perfect copy, because they use these songs to register individual differences and identify individuals based on their song structure. And as I mentioned last week, all of the details of this are learned in the sense that the fine structure of individual notes and the grouping of notes into syllables and song motifs or phrases are copied from a tutor. And we know a lot about the timing of this process, and there's a two-stage mechanism involved in terms of the behavioral effects of auditory experience, an early role for hearing a model, which is, again, analogous to how young infants and children need appropriate exposure to a vocal model in order to develop their normal speech patterns. This is very fast. The total amount of auditory experience is brief, maybe in terms of total auditory exposure, maybe a few minutes of hearing the stimulus over several days is sufficient to drive accurate copying. In an ensuing phase known as sensory motor learning, which is the second stage of learning in the place where auditory experience again is critical, but not experience of an external model. Instead, in this phase is experience of one's own vocalization-related feedback that's critical for normal song development. In contrast to sensory learning, this process is slow. I'll show you evidence today that this looks very much like a reinforcement learning process, but applied in the auditory vocal domain. This takes hundreds of thousands, in most cases for zebra finches like the ones I showed you, hundreds of thousands of trials or song repetitions to drive an accurate copy of the model that was acquired during sensory learning. Just to reinforce this phase and this phase are separated by many months in many songbird species. In the zebra finch, which have a very rapid developmental progression, they're mature in about 120 days after hatching. These processes are overlapping. And then when the animal reaches adulthood, it uses auditory feedback to maintain stable song. In these ways, the dependence on an appropriate vocal model self-generated auditory experience of one's own vocal pattern and auditory feedback for adult maintenance of the vocal pattern. These parallel human speech requirements. These are all things that we require to learn to speak normally. And as I emphasized last week, it just depends how deeply you want to go into this. If you want to go all the way to the molecular genetic level, the parallels are really striking. And this is presumably through constrained convergent evolutionary processes. But I guess the basic premise that I would put out there is the vertebrate brain plan is highly conserved. It doesn't invent a lot of new things, like when I invented the cerebellum with the, the origin of the elasmobranx long, long ago. It kept it, and it almost kept it exactly the same throughout the vertebrate lineage. That's true for the basal ganglia. It's true, really, for most of the major divisions of the brain. Okay, so what I want to talk to you about today, this you can think of as the problem. There's a motor plant that produces song. There's some kind of evaluative mechanism that involves the auditory system that ultimately can evaluate performance in reference to a memory, an auditory memory, and use that to instructively modify the motor plant. That's the basic problem. That seems very simple in some ways. But again, you know, for many of you who are interested in speech, one of the things that's really challenging about this, especially if you want to place it in a reinforcement learning framework, is that salient features of the vocal signal are changing on the millisecond timescale. So the reinforcement mechanisms have to operate on a timescale that's not something that's been probed in other reinforcement learning paradigms using lever pressing or nose pokes like Santiago was talking about yesterday, which occur on a timescale that's 10 or 100-fold slower than what happens with vocal performance of this kind and of speech. All right, so here's what I'll talk about. And I'm going to go pretty fast because, first of all, I'm going to synopsize a lot of published data from our group, but I also want to get into unpublished data in the mouse that may also, reverberate or resonate with some of you who are more interested in mammalian systems. But I'll tell you first that a surprise, and this was just completely serendipitous, is that the motor circuits that are intimately involved in producing the song actually are directly involved in storing the auditory memory of the song. This may represent a general strategy. There are things like mirror neurons in our own brains, which have been postulated to serve this dual function. But in the end, I'll show you evidence that's so, and then I'll talk about the second phase of learning, this sensory motor learning process, and show you that through a variety of manipulations, we can see a role for dopaminergic inputs from the ventral tegmental area into the basal ganglia as a key driver for that process. And then if I have time, I'll talk about circuits for innate vocalizations in the mouse, with a nod to Jim's disparaging comments about the mouse. These are all true. The behavior of the mouse is really impoverished, but the genetic toolkit is unlike anything you can get your hands on. Even though we've pushed really hard with viral gene transfer methods in the bird, the use of transgenic lines in the mouse supersedes anything else except for in flies and zebrafish and C. elegans. And frankly, it's beyond what you can do in zebrafish in many ways. All right, so just again, a quick review. There is a bird brain, and it in sagittal view is shown here, and involves, from the periphery or the kind of neuromuscular structures, motor neurons and respiratory premotor neurons that innervate the vocal muscles of the syrinx and the lateral medullary premotor complex, which again is highly conserved. What distinguishes songbirds, which is just one suborder of birds in the order Passeriformis, from other birds is that they have this constellation of forebrain nuclei that are important to the production of learned song. And I want to draw your attention to this nucleus HVC, which we talked about last week. This is the very dorsum of the telencephalon. If it were in our brain, it would be located right about here, maybe upper parietal cortex or something like that. This is a premotor structure for sure. If this is lesion, the bird can't sing. It has three output cell types, two of which are shown here, one of which goes to the song motor nucleus RA, which forms a projection of these brainstem vocal respiratory plant neurons. And by analogy, this is like the corticospinal projection in mammals. And in fact, in other non-mammalian vertebrates, such direct projections from the telencephalon to the motor neuron pool in the brainstem or in the cord is non-existent. This is very unusual. HVC has an output cell type to that. It has another output cell type that goes into the basal ganglia. And this basal ganglia pathway forms a loop back onto the motor system that is critical for modification of song during juvenile stages of copying and also in adult manipulations that induce vocal plasticity, which I'll talk more about in a little bit. Okay, so that's a big overview, and that circuit puts most people off, but this is a simple way to think about it. There's a motor, premotor network shown in red that's essential to producing song throughout the bird's life, and then there's a cortical basal ganglia loop that's shown in blue here, and the basal ganglia component of this pathway receives input from the VTA and substantia nigra pars compactus. So this is, again, very directly comparable to what exists in our own brain and is critical to certain kinds of motor sequence learning and other complex motor skills like the initiation and termination of those sequences. Okay, so there's song production and the song learning pathway, and the ancient evidence that HVC is critical to singing comes from these kinds of experiments where it's bilaterally lesioned, in this case in a canary, the animal's reduced to these sputtering utterances that bear none of the complex phrase structure of the song. This is, again, you know, not something you'd see in a mouse. So you can remove the whole cortex of a mouse, it still vocalizes normally as far as we can tell. And in fact, even in non-human primates where this has been studied, the role of the lateral motor strip in vocalization is non-existent except when the animal is conditioned to produce vocalizations in response to certain cues. So this sort of higher level control of vocalization is an exception, not the norm. And that would be the picture that you would have if you just interrogated the bird when it was singing. But I'll show you a little video clip of how a former postdoc of mine, John Prather, started to look at it. And that's in a natural setting where the bird listens to a song and sings back to it. This is how the bird uses its song in those species that mark territory by singing, which is most of the species that occupy temperate zones. And what John did is used a miniature microdrive. This was designed by Michael Fee when he was at Bell Labs. This incarnation is a titanium microdrive with very tiny motors made by a Swiss company named Faulhaber that cost about $1,000 a piece. The whole device takes about 2 weeks to build. It costs about $6,000 or $7,000. Then the crazy thing you do is you cement it to the head of a wild songbird like this swamp sparrow, and it immediately tries to fly away and usually snaps the thing off of its head, and then you're back to start. But John didn't know any better, so you know he kept persisting, and he implanted this over HVC. I said, John, this would be a great experiment. You could record while the bird is engaged in this countersinging, and we could really see what's going on when it's engaged in active communication. And he used methods to identify different cell types that I won't go into in great length, but involves anadromic identification of cells. And I'll just show you a recording from one of these cells that projects into the striatum. And the surprising thing immediately was that it wasn't just active when the bird was singing over here, and this is a single unit that's isolated on a multi-unit background. But it was also active during the listening phase when the bird was hearing its song. And again, these took a lot of really challenging experiments to ferret out. But one of the beauties of the swamp sparrow is it sings a monosyllabic trill. And this is the single syllable in this trill aligned during the hearing phase and the singing phase. And in fact, in this case, we were playing one of the bird's own song types to it. So the registration is almost perfect. And you can see that in this case, it's a multi-note syllable. You can then align the data collected during the listening and the singing phase, and it's perfectly aligned, which might lead you to suspect that this activity during the singing phase is auditory feedback driven. In fact, we went to great lengths to demonstrate that it wasn't. It's a premotor related signal. It's completely impervious to auditory feedback manipulations. And as far as we can tell, this cell type in the HVC network is switching very rapidly over tens of milliseconds from an auditory function to a premotor function. That's, again, just by analogy, very much like mirroring in, you know, the premotor cortex in non-human primates, and that some people advance as a substrate for language and communication.
So what is the timing of these responses in the hearing phase and then the singing phase? Is it really the same? Like you have this graph on the right that suggests time in language is hard to believe. If it's premotor, you would expect it. Because earlier, when they sing, then when they listen.
Yeah. So, right. Yeah, that's, again, that We don't know the mechanism for that exactly, but there's some unusual things about the premotor signature in HVC, even in the cell type that goes to the other output I described, that nucleus RA. That is, the timing of the activity in HVC is often perfectly aligned with things that it seems to be involved in producing, not before. There's some timing signatures that look premotor, but others that are more perfectly coincident. And this is a longer digression, but current view is the respiratory vocal pattern generating network in the brainstem is duplexing with HVC to generate, sort of coordinate the respiratory rhythm with these premotor signals. So you can see these weird timing signatures where the activity in HVC actually looks coincident. And in a way, it almost looks like it's delayed, because obviously in the auditory phase, this has to be responding to previous information. The other thing about this is that the timing is really, really tight, and this is not the case in afferents to HVC. So we've done a lot of work mapping this out. This is synthetic. This is something that HVC does to the auditory input to make it very precisely timed. That's not present, at least at the single neuron level, in auditory afferents to HVC. And, you know, one guess is that the system is placing the auditory representation in a premotor kind of equivalent framework. Yeah, Jim.
So that, in effect, is Lieberman's gestural theory of speech.
Yeah.
Which the speech people hate because it's an easily tested and very intelligent idea.
Right. You know, I won't get into all the I mean,
he's an auditory scientist, and they don't like the intrusion of auditory people.
Yeah.
It's
everywhere, and you know, there's a lot of evidence in the human literature now that, for example, the laryngeal motor and tongue motor representations in the primary motor strip are important for people to discriminate voiced speech sounds, but not unvoiced speech sounds, things like that. So I think there are, again, these parallels that are really striking. But
can you get that? Let's talk about that later.
Yeah, that would be a good discussion point. So. Yeah, and you had a question too, I'm sorry.
No, I think it was similar to Ian's question.
Yeah.
Okay. So, sorry to follow up. So when you speak about the delay, one doesn't really know what exactly these neurons respond to, right? So it's hard to, like, what you use as the zero time, so to speak. Is that clearly defined, or?
Yeah, well, this is other published work from our group, but we've done, you know, sort of decomposed the stimulus before in a very ethological way, which is just to play individual notes and note sequences. These are combination sensitive. They require either two or three notes in the preceding gesture. They're also extremely tightly duration tuned. And the duration tuning is very closely parallels the categorical perceptual boundary that you can measure for note duration in these animals. But there are a lot of higher order features. And again, I want to concentrate more on the learning. But it's just to say there is auditory function. So here's another way we've looked at it, and that's to use in vivo two-photon microscopy using lentiviral vectors to express the green fluorescent protein GFP in individual neurons. And then we can make a cranial window over HVC, and during the bird's nighttime, we can go in and either in the dark or under light sedation, we can image the structure of individual neurons with high resolution. When we started this project, we thought, well, here's a premotor structure. Let's go in and see how this premotor structure changes as the bird copies its song, because there should be a lot of action going on. And one of the ways that people have examined how neurons change structurally is by measuring the dynamics of dendritic spines. This is a stretch of dendrite. This is a dendritic spine. This is an evagination of the membrane. And this is in the bird as well as in the mammal, or at least in the mammalian neocortex, the major site of excitatory synaptic contact in the brain. These are specialized structures for receiving excitatory input. And what you can see if you image over a short time frame, like a couple of hours, is that most of the spines are stable. Those are marked by S's. But some spines come, like this one, and some spines go, like that one. And we and others have confirmed that this reflects changes in the synaptic connectivity of the network. You can use this turnover measure, which is a measure of how many spines come and go over a short time period relative to the total pool, and look at those dynamics. And a couple of take-homes are, if in juvenile zebrafinches you compare the rates of turnover in HVC neurons, and this is just any HVC neuron with spines, isolate birds have higher turnover than birds that were tutored. And effectively, this time marks right the very end of the sensory learning phase. This is about when they're going to become refractory to copying anything. And then if you take the birds that are isolated and you introduce them to a tutor and the tutor sings, then the network stabilizes really rapidly. And in fact, in a couple of days and nights, it comes down to levels that are almost adult-like, despite the fact that all the copying is going on out here. So again, this is, you know, this was completely serendipitous in the sense that, you know, we were expecting to see something very different. In fact, it's only when we started manipulating auditory experience to the tutor that we started to see differences in turnover, and we started to see dramatic changes with experience of the tutor. We replicated these experiments using operant tutoring, where the bird doesn't interact with a live tutor, instead pulls a little string and then plays a wave file of a tutor song. That's sufficient to stabilize the network as well. So we think this is auditory driven. Yeah, Ralph.
Could you again explain what turnover means?
Yeah. Turnover is the a measure of how many of the spines come and go over this short time period of a couple of hours. And it's a proxy, Ralph, for measuring the synaptic connectivity of the network. And there's lots of evidence, particularly from the mammalian visual cortical literature, that that maturation and exit from critical periods for visual experience are characterized by a reduction in this measure. Okay, yeah, Chris.
This is really beautiful work, but when I think semantically, when I think spine, I think something kind of somewhat permanent, and this is kind of showing very dynamic turnover. Yeah. So could you just maybe comment very briefly on how you envision precisely what a spine is per se?
Well, there are different classes of spines. That's what you're getting at. That's right, we think about spines. Hopefully, many of our spines in our brain will stay there. At my age now, I'm really getting like more focused on the ones that stay as opposed to building any new ones. Like I, you know, hold on to what you have rather than, you know, build anything new. But in fact, there, throughout life, as far as we know, at least in animal models, there are different pools, some of which are very, very stable, and they'll, you know, persist for days, weeks, and months, and others which are labile and will come and go. And it's thought that those reflect two different types of synaptic connections, ones that can essentially be added or subtracted, and another that stays there. Now, there are other kinds of synaptic plasticity that manifest through changes to stable spines, like you can get increase in spine size. And that's something that also happens when the juvenile hears a tutor. The stable spines get a lot bigger. They get about 30% bigger, which is a really big change. So it's not just these dynamic spines that get stabilized.
So just to be clear, if you had an isolate bird that was not introduced to a tutor, it would stay at a high turnover level.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And there are additional changes that are not shown here that occur actually with crystallization. There's an even increased stability that occurs.
So it's not just a function of age. Like there has to be a tutor
present. That's right. Right. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, because at some point the animals transit to a stable configuration regardless of experience. And if we take animals that are in the stable configuration down here, they won't copy. So they have to be up in, this seems to be permissive for copying the model. Okay. So there are, there are other factors that can stabilize the network in the absence of experience.
So it does appear to be a critical window that is age related, but
that's right. Over normal development, what we conclude from this is that the experience of the tutor stabilizes the network. But given enough time, the system stabilizes on its own. And again, this is sort of thought to be the structural basis of critical periods generally, including for language acquisition. Now, if you don't get the experience before a certain age, you're kind of out of luck, right? And presumably because other developmental programs suppress the plasticity that you need to acquire the skill. Yeah. Ralph.
Turnover is a dynamic measure, right? So it doesn't directly give an idea of how many spines or how many connections.
That's right. So again, in this, if you go to this paper, and I think I posted this in last week's readings, And if I didn't, I will. But we measured other things like spine density, spine size, spine turnover. Spine density goes way up. Spine size of stable spines goes up. And the pool of dynamic spines is reduced. So what we think is happening is a bunch of synapses are being added and stabilized to the network with auditory experience of the tutor song. Yeah.
So as a non-biologist, what I understand is there is a critical period, but it's further to the right than the 60 days of
therapy. This is right at the close of the sensitive period for acquiring a tutor song. And some individuals can still copy at this phase, and others have transited out. There's not a, you know, the actual developmental timing is a little sloppy. It's probably plus or minus a week or so.
Okay, so let's take the individual from the triangle. What would you say? Would you be able to have it learn another repertoire of songs given another tutor?
Not at this stage.
Because it has already learned.
You could do that earlier, and our measurements of birds that have been raised with tutors is that earlier in development, if they've been exposed to a tutor, say, around 45 days, their level of turnover is down here as well. You could take that bird and expose it to another tutor, and it would then also copy that song. But that's, there's an...
So you would have a combination of two effects. One is, of course, age-related, but the other would also be this crystallization. Once it has taken place, it seems to reduce the likelihood of, in combination with the biological age, reduce the likelihood of being able to learn another set of songs.
That's right, and there's probably some adaptive significance to placing the period for memorizing a song in a stage of development when the animal's still dependent on its parents for nutritional support. That way, you're more likely to copy songs of your own species than other species, which in the wild turns out to be a reproductive dead end for a bird. If it copies another species' song, and this happens very rarely in the wild, then they attract their foster species mates and females of the other species, but when the female looks at the male, she recognizes that that's not the right guy and flies away. So that actually the Grants, who've studied Darwin's finches in the Galapagos for many decades, have reported that happening on occasion, that a juvenile will hang out with the wrong species and copy the wrong song. No. Okay, so, those are correlations in both cases. I'll show you this one type of experiment that we've used to interrogate HVC to see if it's actually its activity is necessary during exposure to the tutor song. This involves optogenetics, again, viral gene transfer to express channel rhodopsin, which I think you all know about. And then when you flash light on HVC, you can activate HVC. And the only purpose of this is to disrupt HVC activity, but to do it with some temporal precision that's not possible with chemical inactivation or other slower methods or irreversible techniques like lesions. And then what we do is we take the bird, in this case the juvenile, he's not experienced as tutor, the tutor is on the right, he's going to sing, there are fiber optics going into the HVC bilaterally. Now the only time that HVC activity in the pupil is disrupted is when the tutor is singing to him. And then we can raise the bird up to adulthood with normal HVC activity. This just shows the timeline of the experiment. We disrupt HVC activity in this tutor song contingent manner, raise the bird up to adulthood and measure the similarity to the tutor song, and they don't copy well. So, in fact, they copy very little, if at all. Here's a sonogram of a tutor song from one example. Here's a pupil whose HVC activity has been scrambled during tutoring. Here's a control bird. These are measures of similarity where, you know, it's kind of like if you just show up, you score about 25% using this metric. And so unrelated birds in our colony scored about this level. This is a normal level of copying. And some of the controls involve optogenetic disruption of HVC activity with the same pattern that the tutor would have evoked, but after the tutor has already sung to the bird. So we tutor the bird, take the tutor out, then use the tutor song pattern to drive optogenetic stimulation in the pupil's HVC. That doesn't matter. So HVC is engaging with the network and with somehow with the auditory system to help form the memory of the tutor song.
Okay, Chris. Can you say a few more details about this? So you're transecting channel rhodopsin into HVC, and these are excitatory cells?
This is panneuronal. So this is actually just using a chicken beta actin promoter, so it just expresses panneuronally in HVC.
Okay, so this is increasing, when you stimulate, you're increasing the activity of essentially every cell in HPC as far as you know.
This is an example. No, we're also activating interneurons. So we're doing something more complex than just driving excitation in the network. And again, in this paper, we demonstrate some of the different physiological effects we can see. Usually, you see short latency excitation, but then you can see longer patterns of suppression and mixed effects.
That's surprising. Yeah. So, and do you hit it with the optical stimulation anytime the tutor is singing?
We did optogenetically. We also did these experiments using electrical stimulation. In our hands, optogenetic, because of these mixed effects, and because of this is a case where the latency looks pretty good, it looks pretty short, but in other cases, the latency is, it's more sluggish.
Latency of what?
Of the response to light.
Okay.
So one way we did this is we implanted bipolar stimulating electrodes in HVC and then targeted an individual syllable in the tutor song rather than
the whole
song.
That's what I was gonna ask about.
And what you see is the impaired copying just for that syllable. So if we pick an internal syllable in the sequence, then the bird doesn't copy that one well, but it copies the flanking ones, yeah. So, you know, maybe one way of putting this together in your head is what the animal's doing or what the brain is doing is using this capacity for very precise timing to timestamp the auditory memory, like that's one idea. You know, maybe it's, you know, encoding the memory directly, but it's encoding it in a framework that is like the premotor signature. So the fact that we've seen a transformation in how auditory representations of song are encoded at the level before HVC and HVC suggests that HVC really cares about fine timing in a way that the auditory afferents don't.
When you say it doesn't reproduce the syllable that you're stimulating during, does it just lose the song during that period, or does it snip the song? Does it skip over the
song? No, it just doesn't copy well. So
the time isn't invisible to it.
It seems like, yeah, I'd have to go back and actually look at what we reported. We don't see this elision where it just seals up around the stimulated syllable. It keeps track of something, but it just doesn't register an accurate copy of that syllable. Yeah, Chris.
That might be hard to do, but did you try to change the intensity of the light for different birds and see if there's like a switch? Do they at some point just fail and are able to learn before, or is it more the radio?
We didn't investigate that. Yeah, that might be hard to do, at least with the limited control of channel rhodopsin expression in the system. In the viral vectors, you kind of take what you can get. Okay, so again, so you know, you might say, well, that's nice, but what happens in HVC when the bird is actually first hearing the tutor song? And these are experiments that are ongoing. Masa Tanaka, postdoc in my lab, is doing these using tetrode recordings from HVC in a pupil that hasn't heard a tutor before. So these are really hard to do because the pupils are young, they're pretty fragile. But here's, you get a taste of some of the data he's collecting. So this is important. Zebra finches won't copy from song playback alone. So if you just play song to them, a zebra finch song, they won't copy that. He plays the will-be tutor song to the bird, measures spike discharge. This is from a neuron in HVC that's identified that goes to the song motor nucleus RA. And there's just, you know, it's firing, kind of sputtering along, nothing too impressive. When the tutor's introduced and starts singing, again, you can align the records to the tutor song, the pattern changes. We see this emergence of a bursting structure, but we don't see time-locked activity of the tutor song. But if you then take the tutor out and play the tutor song back, you see this really nicely registered, precisely timed information. This is in about 30 minutes or an hour or so after the tutor's been removed. So this is very, very rapid transformation in the network. And we don't really have total sense of this yet, but maybe one way of thinking about it is it's not a memory when the tutor's present, but it is when the tutor's gone. So, you know, this is some part of a recall network. All right. Now, again, I want to try to get through a couple more things. So just, you know, what, you know, we can conclude now is that there are auditory inputs into the premotor network. And in fact, this structure in the premotor network somehow must be involved in the instructive mechanism because it's involved in encoding the tutor song. But we don't know exactly how, but I'll just summarize a couple more things about what we think is important to learning. Okay, so the next phase is copying, and as I showed you last week, one way you can study this, and this is very, very advantageous because if you study this kind of plasticity in the adult, you have a very, very stable acoustic signature to work from. And this is really useful for certain kinds of experiments. And it turns out that this kind of learning, this noise-driven pitch learning, where you measure the baseline variation in pitch of a target syllable, and then in this case hit lower frequency renditions with white noise bursts, will slowly drive an adaptive change in pitch of the target syllable. This is also dependent on that basal ganglia network. So if you lesion that or inactivate that pathway, the bird can't adapt in response to this. And the underlying idea is really simple. There are premotor inputs into the basal ganglia, and you know, when one of those generates an adaptive output or is associated with an adaptive output, a dopamine signal from the VTA reinforces that, and that bias is cemented into the basal ganglia component of the circuit. And as I discussed last week, that initial bias is then offloaded to the motor pathway over a longer time course. And we wanted to test this very, you know, concretely. This is again using an optogenetic method, but in this case expressing channel rhodopsin and dopamine releasing neurons in the VTA that project into the basal ganglia. Again, just to pump the bird system for all it's worth, you can't do this experiment in a rodent. You can do an experiment like this in a rodent, but the problem with the basal ganglia in the rodent is it's very generalized for a lot of different motor functions. And this structure known as Area X, as far as we can tell, is completely specialized for singing and song learning. So we can do a targeted, an anatomically targeted manipulation and just activate the VTA neurons that innervate this part of the basal ganglia that's important to vocalization. And we've shown through anatomical tracing experiments that the VTA neurons that innervate this part of the basal ganglia are also anatomically segregated. That is, they don't project to other parts of the brain. So we're getting a very kind of pure and specialized dopamine releasing input, and we can get optogenetic control over that. And then we can do an experiment. This is just like the pitch learning experiment I showed you, except there's no manipulation of noise. Instead, we're optogenetically stimulating these terminals in a pitch contingent manner. And just, you know, the background for this is, if you think about it again in the framework of Schultz's, you know, reinforcement learning studies, you'd expect, you know, in a iteration that triggers noise, you should suppress dopamine activity, and iterations that escape noise, that's, you know, a positive thing. You want to reinforce that, dopamine should go high. So we should expect that in contrast to the noise, when we hit the high pitch variant with light, we should reinforce that, and that's exactly what we see here. So this is now catch trials where we're not stimulating with light, but just showing over a course of days, we can bend the pitch upward and toward the direction light is being applied. And this is flexible in pitch. We haven't tried it with other features of the song, but we can target syllables to go up or down, and we can drive the pitch up or down in a magnitude that's approximates what you can do with noise. All right, so that suggests that there is an instructive signal, and you know, that raises the question how that's getting information about instruction. And there was a very nice study that Michael Fee's group published a couple of years ago characterizing cells in a region of the bird's telencephalon known as AIV that projects to the VTA. And they identified neurons that project to the VTA, and they showed that these neurons had some unusual properties. They weren't active when the bird was singing. They weren't particularly active in response to auditory stimuli like noise bursts or noise superimposed on the bird's own song presented to it through a speaker. But if you play noise, like in that pitch learning experiment, there was a short latency burst in activity. So these look like they could be error detectors. These could be components of a circuit that are detecting the noise and relaying that information to the VTA. And presumably, the net effect of this on the VTA is suppressive. So we've also looked at that. And this is using the same approach that I just described to you. And when you punish lower frequency renditions with light, the pitch bends away from the light, which would be the same effect if you use noise to hit the lower frequency renditions. And I don't have time to talk about it, but there's another input to the VTA known as the ventral pallidum, which again is present in mammals, and that input when those terminals to the VT are stimulated, that positively reinforces the system. Now, notably, both of these AIV and VP inputs get input from secondary regions of the auditory forebrain, and I'm not going to go into that today.
Quick question about the cells. So RA is the motor structure. Presumably,
that's
those
right.
cells that project to VTA are not the same ones that go down to
That's the right. It's just this part of the bird's brain is the major outflow tract from the cerebrum. And it contains neurons that project to the brainstem, but it also contains neurons that project to the midbrain portion of the brainstem, including the VTA. These are just a subset of cells in this region that project to the VTA.
Because you said they're reporting an error on the song that the animal is listening, not the one that is producing.
Yeah, they don't seem to show much activity when the bird is singing. Mm-hmm. But if you disrupt auditory feedback with noise while the bird is singing, then they fire briskly. All right, so just a couple more things. I'm not going to talk about this today. There is a paper we just published. It just came out that has a really great illustration that one of the students at Duke made. There is a region known as avalanche, just to really confuse things, that HVC projects to. And in fact, there's a distinct cell type that we identified that projects from HVC into the auditory system. And that has projections to AIV. So you can see in a couple of synapses a backbone for a circuit that could use information from HVC and ultimately provide information about error to the VTA, which could then differentially reinforce the behavior. Now, the thing about this architecture is that's exactly what people have surmised, and I've had a lot of talks with, or not some talks with Peter Hickok about this, but most of the speech people hate the birdsong system. They really do, with a passion, And part of the reason is because they keep proposing things for human speech that they can't actually test that we show exist in the bird, which is aggravating to them, I guess. But one of the ideas, and this is not, unique to speech, is that of a forward model. There's a controller system, in the case of speech or birdsong, manipulates the vocal periphery, but there's also a signal that's linked to the controller system that, through some internal representation of the vocal tract, generates a simulation of what the auditory outcome should be. And the beauty of these kinds of systems, if you talk, I guess there are a lot of people who know a lot about this here, these kinds of forward models are very robust for controlling movement with sensory feedback. But the beauty of this for learning is that you can then compare the output, the auditory feedback from the output, with this computed target and generate an error signal that can iteratively and adaptively modify the controller system, which is really good for learning. Okay, so I'm at 45 minutes. Should I stop?
I think we have time, but please.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, because the mouse stuff is I think will be interesting to people. And this may be broadly interesting to people, not just for the vocalization stuff, but this technique that I'm going to talk to you about that was developed by my colleague at Duke, Fan Wong, is a really powerful technique for genetic trapping that could be very, very useful for auditory studies in the mouse. Okay, so this is where I left off last week. Let's see, learning isn't everything. And you can sort of get a sense for that. So those are innate vocalizations we produce. Those are two or three girls, pranking one. And you can get a lot of it. That's about 2 seconds long. You can get a lot of information from that. Those are presumably all innate. There's laughter, there's fear. It's conveyed very, very readily. Those are not, we don't learn how to do that. And we, in fact, inflect our speech with a lot of innate sort of emotional structure that is not really copied in any sense. Okay, so there's a lot we can learn from innate vocalizations, and that's good because mice don't learn to vocalize. But what I'll tell you about is a strategy we're using to identify these networks for vocalization in the mouse. And I'm going to concentrate on these kinds of vocalizations, if this will play. That's a male chasing a female. And you'll see energy at about 50 to 60 kilohertz that the male starts to produce. This is the male ultrasonic vocalization. These are sometimes called songs. Unlike the bird songs I just told you about, these are not stereotyped in acoustic structure. These are highly variable. In fact, that's one of the challenges to studying them. So if people who are interested in a hard problem, I think analyzing the acoustic features of mouse vocalization is a tough one because there's just the rule is that they are variable, quite variable. All right, so I'm going to concentrate on those adult vocalizations And those are thought to be important to courtship, but in fact, direct tests of that are not very convincing. So I'll show you some of the ways we go about it. There's a region I want to introduce you to. This is called the periaqueductal gray, which sits around the cerebral aqueduct in the midbrain at about the level of the inferior colliculus. It's actually a very long structure. It does a lot of things. But if you are unfortunate and have a lesion in this part of your brain that's bilateral, you will become mute for volitional vocalizations. Most often you just die when you have a brainstem lesion like that. But if you survive, you won't be able to speak. And that's in the literature. Uwe Jurgens and his colleagues have shown that microstimulation in the PAG is sufficient to elicit vocalizations. It's thought that this is a gating mechanism for downstream central pattern generators for vocalization. It's not thought from direct recordings of PAG neurons during vocalization. There doesn't seem to be patterning associated in the activity of PAG neurons with the vocal output, but more of a releaser. But the problem is that the PAG does a lot of other things. It's involved in defensive behaviors, active and passive defensive behaviors. It's involved in respiratory modulation, pain processing, and a host of other things. So it's really, really, really hard part of the brain to get access to in terms of cell types. And what I'll tell you about is a technique that uses the immediate early gene FOS. And this is work from Katie Chita, a postdoc who's working collaboratively between my group and FANS. And what she showed, first of all, is that if you just study the PAG in male mice that are vocalizing in response to a female or in response to female urine, which is sufficient to drive vocalizations some of the time, and compare that to the males that aren't vocalizing in response to the female urine, what you can do is build these consensus maps of where this immediate early gene is expressed. And for the non-biologists here, this is just a technique to a first approximation. This immediate early gene, known as FOST, is expressed at high levels in a way that corresponds to the level of spiking activity in the cells. It's not a perfect relationship. Some cell types don't show that correspondence, but in many parts of the brain, and it turns out here, this is true. So that doesn't really help very much. But what Fan and her postdoc Katsu Sakurai did that's really creative is they generated this kind of lock and key technique using a knock-in mouse line and an engineered virus. And the thing about the mouse line is it's modified so that it produces this gene product under the FOS promoter. So in a cell that produces a lot of FOS, it makes this. Well, what is this? This is an avian viral receptor. This recognizes an avian virus that mammalian neurons won't see because they lack this receptor. But if you make them express the receptor, you can then inject this virus, which is pseudotyped, so it has some of the viral code proteins that bind to the receptor, and it internalizes whatever's in your virus into the cell that's expressing the FOS. This has an added twist. It has this destabilized so-called PES sequence, which targets the receptor for degradation over a very rapid time course of a few hours, which parallels the arc of the FOS expression in the brain. So that's really great, because what it means is if you know where the FOS is expressed, you can go in and inject the virus, and then you can insert your cargo into these cells that were only transiently active during the behavior. And that's very, very hard to do. Okay, so this is the kind of idea. You figure out who expresses FOS, you inject the virus, and then your gene, whatever it is, GFP or channel rhodopsin or tetanus toxin, gets expressed in the neurons. And Katie has been able to do this, and we've done a number of things, but I'll just show you one experiment here, which is to express the tetanus toxin light chain in these cells. This is an activity silencer for neurons. It blocks synaptic release from the neurons that are infected and express this. This is the same male I just showed you. Oh. I think the important thing is the sense that for time is he's completely mute. He doesn't produce these USVs. So he does other aspects of the courtship look normal. He chases the female. He seems to mount successfully, but he doesn't vocalize. And so then you can do something useful, which is study whether it matters to the female. You can give her in this three-chamber test. I really don't like rodent work. It's just, compared to birdsong, it's so contrived. But this is the kind of experiment we can do. We can take a wild-type female. We can express GFP in one male in his periaqueductal gray neurons, and then express tetanus toxin in another. And when we measure the social preference at the outset, we can figure out, what side the female likes to be on, Then we introduce the males and figure out what side they go to, and they switch. They go to the vocal males. So this is a hint that the vocalization actually is important for attracting the female to the male. And then just I'll end very quickly by saying, birdsong anatomists who spent 40 years mapping the circuit for the birdsong system. This is one postdoc working for a year and a half mapping the afferents to this specific cell type, which you can't even do in the bird or the bat or macaques or any, you know, ferrets, using a modified rabies virus tracing method to label the monosynaptic inputs to the PAG neurons that are active during these ultrasonic vocalizations. And it's a broad network. It's really big, but there are some places of interest that immediately pop out, like the anterior cingulate cortex, which again, Juergens described as a major descending pathway for innate vocalizations in owl monkeys. The central amygdala, which also is involved in vocal production, and regions of the hypothalamus that are thought to be important to triggering vocalization in response to sexual cues. And we can trace the downstream connectivity, and as I mentioned, it goes to some places that are suspected to be parts of the pattern generating network, including the parvocellular reticular formation. And that's one of the things that Katie is starting to investigate, is whether selective stimulation of channel rhodopsin expressing afferents from here is sufficient to elicit a full pattern. But what she's done now is to express channel rhodopsin using this Kane method. And you can see what happens here. So we have access, optical access to gating the vocalization. Just a couple points about this. If we just express channel rhodopsin panneuronally in the PAG, the animal does a lot of things in addition to vocalizing, like freezing or running all over the cage. It looks more like a flight response. But when we selectively express channel rhodopsin just in those PAG neurons that express FOS during vocalization, he does this kind of vocalizing. And he'll be grooming, he'll vocalize, he doesn't seem to interrupt his ongoing movements to produce those USVs. So that's where I'm going to end. These are people who did the work. The VTA stuff was done by Aaron Heise and Matt Carney. The HVC recordings I mentioned from Masa Tanaka, and this earlier work from the group, John and Todd, we're off running their own labs, and Malou, who's doing a postdoc at Princeton, and then particularly Katie Cheetah I mentioned, and Valerie Michael, who's a new graduate student in the lab, and then Fan and Katsu, who are collaborators on this mouse work. Okay. Yeah.
Quick question about the last part. So did you say that those are the neurons you're activating are the ones that were activated during natural singing, and not the ones that are projecting to a particular target? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So.
And do you know if these neurons are the ones that project to a particular target?
No. So let me just back up here. When we express, and this is how we trace these descending projections, we use this Kane method, this capturing activated neural ensembles method, to label PAG neurons that are active during ultrasonic vocalization. And in this case, we express GFP and just figure out where the terminals are. Pardon? Yeah. So this is whether they're distinct subsets of PAG neurons that project to these different targets, we don't know that. Right now, we don't suspect.
And those are the ones you're activating.
Yeah. And in this case, we do the same thing, but we're now just shining light on this group of PAG neurons that are those that we've trapped with this method. Okay, thanks.
I think quite understand these experiments concerning these pitch shifts in the songbirds. I think the first thing was when there was some white noise up to a certain frequency, and then, as I understood it, the birds tried to avoid then that frequency band and shift to higher frequencies, so I guess to better hear themselves, right? So it's outside that noise.
Right.
But then you had this optogenetic activation of this area VTA.
Right.
What exactly about this one? How do we think about that? What is that doing? I didn't get how that's then.
Right, sorry. This is very condensed. But okay, here's the behavioral phenomenon you just described accurately. When you hit lower frequency renditions with noise, the pitch of the target syllable moves up over time, over hundreds of iterations. The idea behind this is that the bird is adapting to the noise. It views the noise as somehow interference not necessarily jamming its auditory feedback, but it wants to sing outside of that. It wants to escape that noise. It's probably, the bird probably considers this an aversive stimulus. It's fairly loud. We don't really know, but in addition, there, and I didn't mention this, but should have, there's a really nice paper from Jesse Goldberg's lab showing that VTA neurons that provide input to the specialized part of the basal ganglia, these neurons here, are differentially active on trials that trigger noise versus trials that don't. And their activity is actually suppressed on trials that trigger noise, and is elevated during trials that don't. And the augmentation of the VTA activity on the trials that don't corresponds to the probability in recent history that this syllable would have triggered noise. So in a regime where more renditions trigger noise, the VTA activity scale is actually higher on escapes. And it's thought that this differential panorama VTA activity is the driver for triggering synaptic plasticity in the basal ganglia that ultimately allows the expression of this adaptive bias and output. And this is just...
I guess what I think is that, I mean, it's not just the question, do you have noise or do you not have noise, but if you've got the noise, you're still, the noise exists only up to a certain frequency, right? So in my understanding, that might be important. Maybe it's not, I don't know, but I would imagine that, yes, you've got the noise, but you've got it only up to that frequency, so the bird also knows that simultaneously, for higher frequencies, the noise is not there, and I thought that might be important in the adaptation, but maybe it's not.
You see this with noise, and you see this with these optogenetic experiments. The output continues to probe the, you know, presumably the maladaptive region. It goes into this space, and the variability continues to touch in that region. And, you know, if you do this experiment optogenetically or with noise, and you pair noise or light with all renditions, the system doesn't change. Right? So it needs, this is very consistent with a reinforcement learning strategy where across trials, the animal's exploring output space and finding renditions that are adaptive. And now, the whole thing about this noise approach is that it's very artificial. It's gained a lot of strength because of the power I mentioned in terms of the stereotypy of the adult song. But this isn't what juveniles do. Juveniles are comparing their performance to a memory. Now, they may be detecting errors, but they could also be detecting the goodness of the fit. And that's where we think this other input arm to the VTA may be coming into play. We actually think there are two streams of information operating in a push-pull manner on the VTA, one of which is signaling the VTA that that was a really good copy, and another saying that was a mistake. And through those kinds of levers, you could accelerate learning or optimize learning.
Maybe a rather general question about the songs, but it might actually relate to the reinforcement modeling part. So you have a song, and it also serves as a medium in order to distinguish different individuals. So let's say the song is your template pattern, average song, so to speak, and the individual is a variation, a variance around that mean value, expectation value. How is it balanced when an individual variation stops being just an individual variation, but starts being a different song, so to speak, because it's too far away from this average expectation value pattern? Is it something like the birds listen to various vocalizations around them and discriminately learn where this boundary is? For example, by reinforcement, they hear a different song, and shortly after encounter another individual from a different whatever breed or group or whatever, I have no idea. Or is it something that is more innately biologically controlled as a fixed quantity this variance can take? Has this been researched?
Well, there's a lot in there. So the evidence to date is that male birds that sing use two different neural strategies to recognize songs, one of which is they can just, through experience and presumably through their primary auditory cortical analogs, primary and secondary auditory cortical analogs, learn, oh yeah, you know, that's a song produced by another individual, maybe not even of my own species. And then there's evidence that this whole circuit, including HVC and the basal ganglia component of the circuit, is brought into play for recognizing songs that are very close. And that seems to be where this circuit starts to play a role in discrimination. So, like, recognizing the song of my tutor from the song of a sibling that was exposed to the same tutor, this circuit seems to come into play. Now, you don't need to sing in order to be able to recognize songs, because females recognize songs, and in many, many species, the female doesn't sing. It turns out, though, that if you lesion this structure in the female, she loses her ability to discriminate songs of her own species accurately. Now, I mentioned this briefly last week, but this is a very beautiful study from Elliot Brenowitz from about 25 years ago. He took female red-winged blackbirds, which is a North American species. They have these little red epaulets on their wings or shoulders, and they're otherwise jet black, and very aggressive. The female normally responds just to male red-winged blackbird songs when she's in reproductive shape, when she's ready to breed. And she uses this copulation solicitation display, this tail flip behavior that I mentioned last week, when she hears a song that she likes. And you can use that to measure, is she responsive to the song or not. If you take a reproductively primed female and play a variety of songs, she will only do that display in response to her own species song, including when she's presented with songs produced by mockingbirds, which are very good mimics of other bird songs, including red-winged blackbirds. So when she hears that mimed song, she just completely ignores it. But if you lesion HVC bilaterally in that female and test her again, she starts doing displays to a whole range of songs, not just her own species songs, but other songs, including that mime song and even songs that aren't mimics of her own species song. So, you know, again, you can do other kinds of assays in songbirds to show that they don't need this system to do some kinds of auditory discrimination, but it seems like if they've got it, they use it. And again, my guess is that's analogous to how we employ parts of our own brain that have, through experience and through evolution, been specialized for speech.
I'm not sure whether you mentioned this last time. Either females choose mating strategies based on the specific individual characteristics of the song, because that implies that they have to be more fine-grained and more disciplined.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Again, to me, one can only speculate if this has occurred in the human species. I go back and forth of whether it has or not, but whether sexual selection is acting on learned traits. In the current state of affairs, I'm not so confident. But in general, presumably during human evolution, there has been sexual selection for some learned aspects of behavior, we would imagine. In birds, that seems to definitely be the case. The females are selecting males for a behavioral output that's learned. And that's presumably what's triggered the really striking evolution of the brain and the specialization of these brain regions, is that, you know, this is as strong an evolutionary force as natural selection, and it's acting on a learned feature.
It needn't necessarily be for a learned behavior. I mean, it could also be that the female is looking for other features that are encoded in the sound apart from the song pattern.
Yeah.
Would code for
Sure. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's another, I mean, evolutionary, yeah. The fitness, right. Every example of a sexually selected trait has shown that the gene that's being selected for is directly linked to reproductive fitness, and that's actually the physical linkage of the gene on the chromosome. They're usually very, very close. So there are examples, for example, there's a type of fly that has really widely spaced eyes that the female is selected for God knows what reason. And you know, kind of like antler-like eyes. And That's been shown in those flies to be very closely related to, like, you know, sperm viability or some other aspect that actually relates to the reproductive fitness of the male. It's not known what this, I mean, the genes that actually are important to song learning are probably very many, and how they correspond with reproductive fitness isn't well understood. But that's the underlying idea. There's no question that the female cares about the learned traits, because if you give her a choice to select a song that's the isolate song that doesn't have these learned features, she's not interested. As long as she has a learned song to choose over that, she prefers the learned song. So there's something that the male learns to do that's attractive to the female. Yeah. Okay?
Just one very brief comment. I'm not sure if this is of any relevance or interest, but do you know about the raging torrent frog? So this was a species of frog in China that lives in these canyons, and it's like there's waterfalls shooting through, and it's deafening. Huh. And they found out that these frogs somehow can communicate at ultrasonic frequencies. And it's been interesting because, like, you know, for hearing folks, frogs don't hear at ultrasonic frequencies, so how do they do that? But on the flip side, relating back to some of this stuff, you know, they had an evolutionary pressure to kind of push them out of their normal vocalization range, and they found a way to do it. So I don't know, from a neuroecological point of view, if there's any interesting parallels in kind of the control back down about how they do those vocalizations.
Now, I don't know about those frogs at all. That's a great name. But but I do know some work from Christina Portfors that relates to mouse USV. So she's looked at the representation of ultrasonic frequencies in the inferior colliculus and of the mouse. And that representation is actually very small. And so she's favored the idea that what the mouse is doing is not actually processing ultrasound per se, but there are discontinuities in the syllables, and the response function of the periphery is such that those jumps are sufficient to create difference tone effects. And and those all occur in a lower frequency, or are present in a lower frequency register. And she maintains that's actually what the mouse is doing, that it's using ultrasound to create a cryptic signal that then can be decoded through a difference tone effect. But that's just an idea. So there may be strategies where you can do that. But just as an aside, environmental factors in birdsong are really well documented. This kind of, you know, the Lombard effect, which is a vertebrate-wide phenomenon where animals vocalize more loudly in noise. In urban environments, you can show that songbirds actually sing more loudly. They will bend their frequency if they can get above the ambient noise. And there's a lot of adaptive stuff there. Okay. Thanks for indulging me with the extra time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks very much again.